Accession number 27767, Reel 5.
Adrian Holloway, Reel 5.
So, after the Battle of... Sorry.
It's all right, you carry on, yes.
After we were to relax a bit, and one has to remember that being in Alexandria, which was a very ancient seaport, had its compensations. The weather was usually delightful, and there were quite a lot of things to do. The main thing which I simply loved was the Sporting Club of Alexandria, which had a beautiful swimming pool and tennis courts, and I used to go there as often as I could. There were cinemas to see, which all the latest films were shown. I was madly in love with Diana Durbin and went to see all her films. Then there was very good restaurants, one called Pastoudis, which was run by a Greek, where you could get a delightful meal, and nightclubs called the Monseigneur and so on, where you could see a floor show. So really, the case for relaxation in Alexandria, which we jolly well all deserved, could be amply fulfilled.
So, I mean, masses of naval people in Alexandria. Were there also British Army? And
No. There was a complete embargo on the Navy going to Cairo and similarly the Army coming to Alexandria. It was the old wartime thing, is your journey really necessary? And that was really what annoyed me, because Valiant, my battleship, had to go into dry dock to have her bottom scraped. Any tropical water produces enormous barnacles on a ship's bottom, and of course it reduces her speed. So she had to go into harbour and have the bottom scraped. And she was going to be in for 48 hours. So I applied for leave. There's nothing we could do. And I asked for John Cardew and myself to go to Cairo. Flat refusal. Not allowed to do it at all. So he and I took a very nice room at the Cecil Hotel and had a very good time. But unfortunately, later on, we both contracted that awful disease of jippy tummy, which kept us absolutely flat for about 48 hours. No, Alexandria was really a very nice city to be in. And although, of course, it was frequently bombed, but... I think it's true to say that certainly no naval ship was ever hit, but sometimes a mine was dropped in the harbour which would inhibit movements in the harbour till it had been rendered safe. Yeah. Yeah.
Did the officers go to the same sort of restaurants and so on as you, or did you sort of separate yourselves?
Ah, well, there was a thing called the Union Club, and that was only open to lieutenant commanders and above. So we weren't allowed in that. But certainly you would see them at Pastoudis and so on. My turret officer, Lieutenant Barnes, who loved his food, would, of an evening in the wardroom, send for the wardroom steward, look at the menu and say, "Certainly not. I'm going ashore to Pastoudis."
What was the food like on board, generally?
Plain, but perfectly adequate. And, of course, we never lacked for it, because we were, you know, whilst there was rationing in England, there was bags of food to be had. What would happen was that the wardroom and the gunroom each had a messman. Very often in some ships, he was a Maltese and therefore knew how to bargain. And so he would go ashore and do a great big purchase of food from the locals, and he'd know how to, you know, get it cheaply and so on and buy the best. And we didn't have a Maltese, but that was the sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how long did you got some leave in Alexandria? How long was that?
48 hours. And I think we spent most of it at the sporting club. On reflection, I feel that we ought to have seen more the sort of historical parts of Alexandria, but being very young and, let's face it, in a constant possibility of death, we just enjoyed ourselves. So that's really what we did.
And were the floor shows very naughty?
No, not particularly. I suppose there were topless dancing girls. I suppose there were. Yes, I think so. But girls were in rather short supply there. Mm.
So
the ship. The next thing. I have to relate some tactics about this because our next operation was to be an extraordinarily dangerous one, and one which could have literally decimated or destroyed most of the Mediterranean fleet. What had happened was this, that Churchill and the War Cabinet put great pressure on Cunningham to close the harbour of Tripoli, because through it was flowing all the panzer tanks and so on for the Africa Corps to fight in the Western Desert. And things were becoming very, very difficult. He was ordered originally to take the battleship Barham into the harbour of Tripoli and sink her as a block ship, which he resolutely refused to do because he would lose a battleship, and it was a most ridiculous operation which would probably have very little chance of success. Anyway, when we got to sea, the commander broadcast that we were to bombard Tripoli, and I must say this was a thing which really made me have an awful jolt at the pit of my stomach. I mean, talking about Drake singeing the King of Spain's beard, this was really doing it, because it was as if the Italian fleet had appeared off Alexandria and was bombarding there. It was the main Italian enemy port. And so what happened was that we arrived off Tripoli at 2 in the morning, and I was wondering how we were going to do it. But there, sitting on its station, was the submarine Truant, which blinked a little light at us, and we set off from that rather like an usherette showing you to a seat in a cinema, because we all had to steam up and down, sending our shells into Tripoli. And there were these three battleships, all of which were firing, and we fired one side and then turned round and fired the other. And meanwhile, our aircraft was spotting overhead. Once again, I was down in the bowels of the ship, and so I saw nothing of this. But it was an extremely dangerous operation to have undertaken. And why we were very lucky was that, again, Enigma had saved us, because they knew that there were no mines where we were. A month afterwards, the Germans laid an enormous minefield, which destroyed two cruisers later on in the year and could have easily sunk us all.
What time of day did this bombardment start?
It started at 2 in the morning.
Right.
And our aircraft, which was spotting overhead, again said that they couldn't see anything because the clouds of dust raised by our shells were...
So you were in B turret?
No, I was down in this HGCP, which was down in the bowels of the ship.
Yeah. Right. So you had no idea what really was going on?
No, I had no idea at all. And
was that the most nerve-wracking place?
It is. Really? It is, absolutely. Mm. Because you've no chance of getting out. You close this hatch on top of you. It's like closing the hatch of a submarine. And as happened at the time of the dive bomber attack, it could buckle if it was if the ship was hit, and then you'd never get out.
Yeah. So, who was there with you?
With me in this little compartment, which was no... I don't know how you would describe this in dimensions, but it was no bigger than this. Yeah. Full of instruments and dials and heaven knows what else. There'd be a leading seaman and about five ratings. And you had to be with them 4 hours on, 4 hours off the whole time at sea. And believe me, their conversation, they were all Liverpudlians and considered mostly of a copulative adjective. nothing else, practically. Oh, it was terrible. I didn't like them at all. So... I don't know. It's very difficult for me because I don't want to get into the technicalities of the thing, you know. And
so you were down there. It starts at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, and I suppose it went on for about half an hour, and then we made off back home. We were bombed once on the way back, but it all went like clockwork. At which I was absolutely amazed because originally I'd been horrified at the thought, absolutely horrified. I mean, imagine the German Navy coming off Portsmouth. Quite incredible.
Yeah. And you could see very little of what was going on.
So nothing at all.
Putting your life in the hands of everyone else.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What was the mood on the ship like after that?
I think the mood was of exuberance, really, but they weren't quite certain how much damage had been done, and to be frank, apparently we didn't do very much. I think the port was working within a week.
Yeah.
So all that terrible risk had been taken, really for very little. The RAF had come to bomb it after we'd finished. They should really have done the whole job. It was absolute folly to have risked the fleet like that, I think. Absolute folly.
So all back to Alexandria again.
Yes. And then comes Crete. Now, do you want to...
Yes, yeah, if you're happy to...
Yep. Okay, just a sec.
So at what stage did you know that Crete was going to be the next venture? Did they give you a briefing about that?
Well, as regards Crete... we, of course, read the newspapers, and you'd get the BBC news from London, although in a rather sort of crackled way. And we knew that the Germans were... They'd reached the mainland of Greece. They'd come all the way down to Athens and the Piraeus. And... my nice friend David Peck, who I mentioned earlier, had shown us into around the ship. He had been sent to the destroyer Rhinek to do 3 months' destroyer time, as we all had to do. And he was killed by a German bomb, which we were all very sad about. It was at that time that I myself had to go and do my destroyer time. Every midshipman is sent to a destroyer for 3 months to learn what it's like. And it is a very different life. Now, I was given 4 hours to pack and so on, and was told I had to join the Australian destroyer Nizam, which hadn't even arrived in Alexandria at that time. She'd come round the Cape from England with an Australian crew, and she'd been coming from Port Said. Well, she came into harbour, and I was sent off to join her. And from the very first, I knew that this was going to be an extremely unpleasant time for me.
what was it like going onto that destroyer for the first time? You know, what was
well, absolutely right. I was met by an Australian destroyer, midshipman called Richardson, who looked to me like a Bondi Beach lifeguard. I mean, he was a huge, great chap, and I thought, oh dear, I don't think I shall live up to Richardson's standards. And the atmosphere on board was much more relaxed in a way and more matey from the crew's point of view, ship's company. They didn't quite call you Cobber, but you always felt it was waiting to come out. And I hated the Australian accents, and I was the only Englishman on board. And they would always be talking about, oh, the bloody Poms and so on, and getting on and getting... Well, I was very junior. I couldn't talk back to them. And I thought it was really very unfair. But the only thing was that I did, for the first time in my life, I had a cabin to myself, which was absolutely splendid. Of course, later on, if senior officers came, I had to give up my cabin, and then it was just the wardroom cushions for me. I had to doss down there. But almost as soon as I joined, the battle for Crete had started, and we went to sea, and the first thing I knew, of course, the difference between a battleship and a destroyer was that Vernet had hardly rolled at all, but Nizam pitched and tossed and turned, and I was violently seasick. Now, you take it that you go on watch on the bridge and you're feeling frightfully seasick. It isn't funny, because you've got to do your job. And you just stand there with a bucket on the bridge and that's that.
And not too much sympathy from the Australians.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That's quite true. So our first job was to bombard the island of Scarpanto, which is an island about 50 miles east of Crete, because it was thought that there was a dive bomber base there. And we crept into this... Sorry, can you stop a moment? So we and three destroyers were sent out to bombard the airfield there. I was given the job of midshipman of the plot. In other words, I had to keep the ship's dead reckoning position, which would then be corrected by the navigating officer taking sights. But it was quite a responsible job, and I was also the information officer trying to collate the various signals that came in as to what was happening elsewhere, and present a coherent, to the captain. I'd never done such a thing before, and it was rather difficult to do, especially in wartime.
So you suddenly got a lot of responsibility.
Yes, I think I did, really. Mm. Anyway, we arrived at this place, Scarpanto, and we fired off our guns, but we'd been hoping to find some... enemy forces in the harbour. We fired a star shell, which illuminated the harbour, but there was nothing there. Then, as I was standing on the bridge, a large Australian signalman said, "Gaw, look at that." And we all looked over the port side, and there was the track of a torpedo coming straight towards us. And we all held our breath. But fortunately... what the dear old tennis commentator Dan Maskell would have called an unforced error, had caused the enemy to set it too low, and it passed right under us, and we heard it explode on the beach. So we really had been terribly, terribly lucky. We wondered what had fired it, a submarine or an E-boat, but we think that it was an E-boat because it was too shallow for a submarine. But we had been very, very close to death at that time, either that or we would have been taken prisoner and spent the rest of the war in prison camps.
Was Scarpanto defended? Or?
No, it wasn't defended at all. It was a complete and utter waste of time, as is so are so many things in wartime. Well, then we came back to Alexandria and had to refuel. A destroyer, of course, is much less like a battleship. It has continually to refuel. If it's with the fleet, you do it at sea from a bigger ship, but that couldn't be spared at the time. And so you had to come back to Alexandria to refuel. And when we got back to Alexandria, we were told we were to take some troops called commandos to Crete. Well, nobody had heard of anything called commandos at that time. It was entirely new. And when I saw this motley crowd of men brandishing knives and polishing knives and absolutely festooned with weapons and heaven knows what, I felt rather like the Duke of Wellington by Gad, sir. I don't know what they do to the enemy, but they certainly frightened me. They came on board, and we duly set off to Crete. And we'd had to take on two extra whalers, large boats, to send them ashore in and so on. And I then learnt that the Mediterranean is not a very pleasant sea in times. It could be an absolute bitch. And we came in for a most frightful gale. We pitched and tossed and heaven knows what else. And what I found that in a destroyer was so difficult was that in those awful conditions, you can't go through the ship below decks as you would in a battleship. You've got to go above decks because it's all welded together. And so you've got to hang on tightly to a jackstay or something like that to prevent yourself being washed overboard. And in order to make my way to the bridge where the plot was, from the wardroom, it was really a hazardous thing, besides stepping over the bodies of recumbent soldiers, who by then were sort of being seasick and so on. So that was very pleasant. I mean, they were being sick down below and sick on the deck. And then the two whalers were washed ashore, and finally somebody said, thank God, we had to return to Alexandria. We couldn't undertake the thing, and it was hopeless. We'd never have made it.
Why couldn't you undertake it?
Because it was far too rough.
Right.
Probably we would never have, reached the beach, and the two whalers had been washed away by the huge waves. How were we going to get them ashore? There was probably no jetty there and so on. So we went back, and we then made another trip to take them back. This time, it was really the most awful sentence that we had to do, because we had to go to Souda Bay, which is on the northern side of Crete and about the only decent harbour. Now, Cunningham had said that if Crete had been turned upside down, it would have been fine, because all the good harbours to the north, and we were to the south, and it meant you had to go round Crete in order to get to a decent harbour. And by this time, the Mediterranean fleet was having a terrible time. In the signals that I was getting, the cruiser Gloucester, which I had seen launched at Plymouth in 1937, she'd been sunk, and later on the cruiser Fiji, which had gone to her rescue. And they weren't very far from us. And so it was with bated breath that we sailed and steamed on towards Crete. And you kept looking up at the sky because you feel so naked in the open sea. There's nothing to hide from, nothing. You're completely exposed, beautiful blue sky, which would do wonderful for the tourist trade, but for enemy aircraft, it was really quite frightful. And the incredible thing was that we never saw an enemy aircraft at all.
Really? You set off from Alexandria.
Yes.
On the way to Crete.
That's right.
And to see if you never saw an enemy aircraft.
No, we never did. And Then we crept into Suda Bay, I suppose about 1 o'clock in the morning, and there was a complete vision of hell, because ships were burning, they were gurgling as they were settling down in the water. The whole place was in complete darkness, of course, except occasional flashes. By that time, the Germans were only 8 miles away. You could hear the chatter of their machine guns. And it really was an extraordinary feat that we were able to go alongside. I don't know how it happened. I think there was probably a launch that they sent out with a small white light. And there were four of us. Each had a white light on the stern, so you followed the white light ahead of you. But you see, you had to proceed so carefully, and a ship is not like a motor car. You can't manoeuvre. If you go slowly, you've got no steerage way. If you go too fast, you'll end up in one of the wrecks and the Luftwaffe will find you the next morning. And it was absolutely vision of hell. It smelt of death and defeat somehow. And eventually we got alongside. It took us an hour and a half, which would normally have taken about half an hour. And then a thing occurred that normally never does. There was clear lower deck was sounded. Now, clear lower deck is a thing that is hardly ever done in the Navy. It's usually done if the captain wants to address the ship's company. But it means that everybody, officers included, has to do his job. So what we were doing, and I included, of course, was passing all this food and ammunition down onto the quay, and the soldiers were disembarking. And I remember thinking how awful, how really, really awful to be a soldier, because there they were being pitchforked into this awful chaos. We at least had a chance of getting back. We didn't know that they were going to be all right. In the end, they were. But and somebody came aboard who was later to come back with us, and he said it's complete chaos ashore. Nobody knows who's doing what. Everybody's running around like headless chickens. So we thought, thank you very much. That's very nice. And then we took off some wounded, and our doctor got busy. Then eventually, after that, we were able to leave. And as we were leaving Suda Bay, I've never felt more thankful to feel the ship's engines thrumming under my feet. As we started to leave the harbour, still, of course, in complete darkness, a German plane started dropping flares, but each time it was just astern of us, so he didn't illuminate us. But we had our hearts in our mouths. And then, of course, we had to get out of Suda Bay and go round the eastern tip of Crete in order to start south for Alexandria. And that was when the unpleasantness started, because at 5 o'clock it became dawn. We were in the Kazo Strait, just to the eastern end of Crete, and down came the bombs. And our sister ship, Havoc, was hit, but she wasn't damaged too much, and she was able to continue. We twisted and turned, and a leading signalman and I took refuge under the plot itself whenever a bomb was coming down. You could hear it screaming, and we thought, I suppose, really, that it was better to get shrapnel in our bottoms than it was in our heads. So there we were, like sort of under the plot, which really afforded us very little protection. But our captain was wonderful, and he would watch for a bomb being dropped from the aircraft, which was fairly high at those high-level ones. And he would see where it was coming and then put the helm over and hope to miss it. But there again, the screaming of the bomb was too awful. I should think that's about almost enough, isn't it?
Yeah. So how did the Australians, I mean, you know, they're they weren't that easy to work with at first, by the sound of it. How were they under fire? Were they?
Oh, they were very good. Mm. Yeah, this is again a digression. I mean, apparently in Singapore they were awful. They rushed the boats. They held up women and children with guns and so on, and some were quite terrible. They drank all drink that there was to be had, and so on. But no, I have nothing but praise for them in that respect. Yeah,
yeah, because you went through the fire with them, didn't you? Really?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you said you brought some wounded off Crete. What sort of number do you know?
Question. I don't know. I suppose there were about 20, maybe
Did
more.
Did you see more wounded or people waiting to be taken off?
You couldn't see a thing.
Couldn't see a thing, right.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. There weren't light standards going around the quay.
No, I wondered if you were.
No, it was all in complete darkness, you see.
Yeah.
But there again, the wounded were an awful nuisance to us because, poor things, a lot of them were on the iron deck, the upper deck, and lying there. And, of course, we, in order to get to our action stations, we had to hop over them as well as, stop yourself from getting in the sea.
Yeah.
So that wasn't so funny.
No.